Boker Tov. February 15th, Sunday morning, Shari Tfilah, our class in Introduction to Mishnah and Talmud. We're learning Masechet Pesachim, Perek Bet, the 10th chapter, and we've reached Mishnah Dalet, the fourth Mishnah. We'll just briefly review to remind ourselves what we did the past 2 weeks. So everyone has the Mishnah in front of them. And it says the beginning of Perek Arvei Pesachim, Perek Asiri, the 10th chapter. It began, Arvei Pesachim Samuch Lemincha, Lo Yochal Adam Ad Shetech Shach, right? Arvei Pesachim, the evening of Pesach, Samuch Lemincha, Ner Mincha Time. We said that means half an hour before Mincha. We said Mincha is Mincha Ktana, which is 9.5 hours of halachic hours. A half hour before 9.5 is 9. In other words, 9 hours from the beginning of the halachic day, Lo Yochal Adam, can't eat. In order that you go into the Chag, into the Seder, into the evening of Pesach and Matzah with Teavon. I shouldn't say it's basically based on a matzah. You should eat the matzah with teyavon, with an appetite. Ad shetech shach, until it gets dark. We learn from that that you can't begin the seder ad shetech shach until it's dark. And then we learn v'afilu ani shavi Yisrael lo yuchal ad sheyaseiv. Even the poor person in Israel can't eat unless he's reclining this night. We talked about reclining. Lo yifchatu lo mi'arba kosot shel yain v'afilu min ha'tamchui. And the those who dispersed tzedakah funds should not give less than 4 cups of wine to anyone, even to the poor person, even from the tamhui, which is the chest really for the most basic needs, never less than 4 cups. So we said this Mishnah, the first Mishnah, is not about the Seder of the Seder, it's about the preliminaries of the Seder. It's about what happens before the Seder, and it's about general rules that you have to know going into the Seder, but it's not about yet the order of the Seder. Whereas the next Mishnah begins actually the rudimentary framework of the Seder as it was 2,000 years ago and begins with Mishnah Bet, Mazgulo Kos Rishon. You need? Mazgulo Kos Rishon. They poured from the first cup, Beit Shammai Omrim, and then Beit Hillel. We saw here that the same machloket that we have in Masechet Brachot over the order of Birkat HaYayin and Birkat HaShabbat, Birkat HaKiddush, there's a machloket. But it begins with Kiddush on the first cup. And then we said the third Mishnah, which is what we did last week. Hiviu lefanav, they brought before him, it doesn't say what. Mitabel vechazeret ad shemagia lepar peret apat. And we said that's a bit complicated. Literally it means you dip with chazeret, which is romaine lettuce, before you even get to the palperita pot, even before you get to the vegetable that serves as the accompaniment to the bread. And this night, the bread is the matzah, and the accompaniment is, of course, the maror. So what it says is, you eat romaine lettuce, which is the best of the 5 vegetables to serve for maror. It says you eat maror before you get to maror. We talked last week that the Gemara says it's a case in which you only had romaine lettuce. That's all you had. There were no other vegetables this night. And it's telling you, you're allowed to use the romaine lettuce for the first dipping, even though you have not yet gotten to the mitzvah of maror. Which tells us there is a first dipping. And you can use the maror for it. If you have a better vegetable, like a carrot or celery like we do today, then that's better. So you have a first dipping that comes before the second dipping, the second eating of chazeret that's also going to be dipped. And then he viewed lefanav matzah v'charoset, v'chazeret v'charoset u'shnei tavshilin. They brought before him the matzah and the chazeret and the romaine lettuce and the charoset and the shnei tavshilim. Even though the charoset is not a mitzvah, we said it's a machlok, the mitzvah not a mitzvah. If it's a mitzvah, it's only the Rabbanan, to remember the teeth, remember the mortar. Whereas the other things brought, the matzah is a mitzvah deraita, the chazeret is a mitzvah deraita, and the shnei tavshilim, we said, are after Chorban HaBayit. One is a memory of the Korban Pesach, the other is a memory of the Korban Hagigah. We said that the Gemara says you can use, for example, beets and rice. It doesn't really matter what it is. And we also said that in certain nuschaot, in certain versions of the Mishnah, like in Yerushalmi, I think it was, the words Shnei Tavshilim do not appear. They were apparently added after Chorban HaBayit. When the Bayit was standing, you didn't bring Shnei Tavshilim, you rather brought the Pesach and the Chagigah. Right? And then Rabbi Lazar Bar Tzadok says, mitzvah, the charos is a mitzvah, just like I mentioned, there's a machloket mitzvah, not mitzvah. Uve mikdash hayu mivim lefanav gufo shel Pesach. In the mikdash, they brought before him, not the two tavshilim, but the gufo shel Pesach, the carcass of the Pesach. And we mentioned last time that in the Yerushalmi, there's a different nusach in these last few words. It's not the mikdash hayu mivim, it's uve mikdash mivim, without the word hayu. And that's probably the language that we had during the time of the Mikdash. And what it meant to say is that if you're doing your Seder outside of Ir HaMikdash, the city of the Mikdash, then they didn't bring before the Gufo Shel Pesach. But if you're doing your Seder in the Mikdash, then Mivim Lefanav. In other words, when it says Mivim Lefanav, it's a geographical distinction and not a chronological one. It's geographically saying if you're in the Mikdash, Mivim, and if you're not in the Mikdash, not. The word Hayu was probably added in after Chorban HaBayit to say that they used to bring it, but today we don't bring it. But probably it wasn't there in the original version. One.
I thought you were done with your review, and I want to ask
you. So this is part of review still. One of the most important things we talked about last week was the question of when do we eat? Assuming that this is a rudimentary framework of the Seder, and it is. Well, in our Seder we know that we have the tibul we show in the first dipping, which is here described as being chazeret, but it could be with something else, as we say. And then we know we tell the story. The four questions in the story, the magid. Whereas here it says that they bring the food. And we said that most logically speaking, in a very simple, straightforward sense, if you bring the food, the reason is probably to eat it. Especially since they're bringing the Gufo Shel Pesach, and it's right straight from the barbecue, and if you wait an hour, two, or three to eat it, it's going to get cold. Why would they be forced to eat cold food on this night? And we talked about the fact that most probably what happened in the Zman and Mikdash, the time of the Mikdash, is that they brought the food and they ate it. Why did they eat the meal before the mitzvah magid? Because in those days, the meal was the mitzvah. Right? Matzah is certainly a mitzvah. And the dinner, which today we have chicken or brisket, whatever it is, in those days it was gufo shel Pesach and the gufo shel chakigah. That was the major mitzvah, the korbanot, together with the matzah and the maror. Just like the Torah says, Pesach matzah maror, al matzot morim yuchlu. You should eat it, the korban Pesach, with matzah maror. That's the mitzvah of the day. And then later follows the story. After you've already eaten the mitzvah, done the mitzvah, then the Seder follows. And we'll see today that it makes perfect sense that you talk about the story after the meal has been eaten, because now you have something to talk about. Why did we eat this meal? What was special about it? You would be hard-pressed to start talking before you had the meal, because what do we talk about? And if you've never had a Seder before, how do you ask about why are we eating matzah if you didn't eat it yet? There's no reference point. It makes perfect sense to eat it and then ask, why did we eat it? We'll get into that more of that today. So, number one, just like we said, in those days they probably ate the meal first, they brought the food and ate it, and then they told the story. The order was changed after Chorban HaBayit at a certain point because the meal was no longer mitzvah. If you had chicken or you had whatever you had, that wasn't a mitzvah. It didn't have the gufo shel Pesach anymore. It was replaced with food. So then we tell the story first, and then later we eat the meal. And that's point number one. Point number two, and this last point to review last week, is the matter of akirat the shulchan, the removal of the table. And we said that some people in their Haggadot can see, let's see if this is mine. This is mine. That at a certain place in the Haggadah it says, right, I'll just give you an example. In my Haggadah, right after we begin, right after Karpas and Yachatz,
give him
my Haggadah says, the Seder plate is removed. The Seder plate is removed. I can look actually if it has it in here.
I think it does. I remember correctly.
Let's see.
Before Magid, right? Karpas.
This one doesn't seem to have it. It's right before Magid. No, this one doesn't seem to have it. In many Haggadot, you have something like the Seder plate is removed, or the Seder plate is pushed aside, or at least, sometimes it says the matzah is covered.
Yeah, it did say.
The matzah is covered. Okay. That is, you're looking for where it is, David?
I'm okay.
Right, the matzah is covered. That's on page 8 in the italics. The plate is put down, the matzah is covered. The matzah is covered is what's left of the Seder plate is removed, which is what's left of the food is removed, which is what's left of the table is removed. The ancient custom was the table is removed. So why would the table be removed? Well, that brings us back to Masechet Brachot that we learned last year and here before.
No connection to halacha, right?
No connection to halacha. Rather, the custom was they ate on these small tables, whether they were eating misubin or yoshvim, they ate on these small coffee tables. And at the end of the meal, they would simply remove the plata, remove the tray from the legs that remained there, and shake it out the window, or shake it into the garbage, and then bring the plata back. So in the time of the bayit, of Beit HaMikdash, they'd have a meal every night, and then after that, remove the table. At the Seder, they'd also have a meal and remove the table. So if we want to go back to the order of the Mishnayot, if we assume that Mishnah Gimel says that they brought the food and ate it, then obviously after eating it, they would remove the table and then bring it back, empty, without the crumbs, without the dishes, without anything on it, in order to have a clean table to say Berkat Mazon, or in this case, to tell the story. In any case, apparently what happened historically is that the eating of the meal was removed from this point of the Seder and made later, but the removal of the table was not removed. They left the custom of removing the table, even though there was no logical reason to do it anymore, because there was no dishes to clean off. They hadn't eaten yet once the eating was moved to the end of the evening, but removing the table remained as a mechanism to get the kids to ask what's going on here. So it's not that Chachamim invented a crazy act of removing a clean plata. It's rather that they took a traditional act that had nothing to do with halacha and turned it into a means for furthering the curiosity of the kids.
Could it have been even unconsciously that that remnant was left, and that the custom of removing the table maybe was not conscious? They didn't consciously decide we're going to keep this. But
I guess that's for the realm of anthropologists to, you know, go to how these things develop.
Right.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
David, you wanted to?
I remember the answer to my question.
Ah, okay.
Thank you.
Okay. That's the end of the review. Are there any questions or comments? No. So we begin now today. We're in Mishnah Dalet. Everyone is in front of him.
So they didn't have like a yachat, or they just ate and then talked about the Seder?
That's hard to say. There certainly could be things not listed in the Mishnah, but were customary to do. Yachatz is mentioned in the Gemara. Is that a new custom, or is it just a recording of an ancient custom? Don't know. Okay, so now, the Mishnah says, Mishnah Dalet, Mazgu lo kos sheni, v'chan haben shoel aviv. They poured for him a second glass, and here the child asks his father. Vim ein dat baben, aviv milamdo. And if there's no intelligence in the son, his father teaches him. Ma nishtana halayla hazeh, what is different of this night, mikol halelot, of all nights, that is compared to all nights, shebechol halelot, for all nights, anu ochlim chametz u'matzah, we eat chametz or matzah, halayla hazeh kulo matzah, this night kulo matzah, shebechol halelot, at all nights, anu ochlim shar yirakot, we eat the rest of the vegetables, Alayla hazeh maror, this night maror. Shebechol halelot, anoch lim besach sli shaluk mevushal. All night we eat meat that is roasted or is boiled extremely. What a translation. Or mevushal, or boiled slightly. Halayla hazeh kulot sli, this night kulo roasted. Shebechol halelot, anu matbilin pamechat. All nights we dip once. Halayla hazeh, this night shtei fa'amim, twice. Ulefi dato shel ben aviv milamdo, and according to the intelligence of the child, his father teaches him. Matchil bignut, begin with disgrace. Umsayim b'shevach, and end with greatness or praise. B'doresh me'arami oved avi ad shigmor kol ha'parsha kula. I don't want to translate that. We're going to go back word by word, as usual. Word by word. Going back to the beginning of the Mishnah, I'll translate again a little bit, and we'll look at the questions. Mazgu lo chos sheni. They poured for him a second glass. Vechan haben shoel aviv. And here the child asks his father. Veimein dat beven aviv milamdo. And if there's no intelligence in the son, his father teaches him. Ma nishtana, etc. The four questions. Okay. So we go back now to the first four words. Mazgu lo kos sheni. And we try and see the patterns in this chapter of Mishnah. So those four words, mazgu lo kos sheni, in a very specific sense, they remind us of a phrase that opened the previous Mishnah. And the more general sense, they remind us of the style of opening a number of Mishnayot in this chapter. So let's answer my question, which was, on the question sheet, how is the opening of this Mishnah similar to that of the previous two Mishnayot?
So they put something before him.
Right. Right.
And there's only one word difference, the Mishnah bet. Mazgul kos rishon, mazgul.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So that's... that's exactly it. The second Mishnah said Mazgulo Kos Rishon, and now the fourth Mishnah says Mazgulo Kos Sheni. Is clearly an effort here to show us that a structure is being developed, a structure that repeats itself. There's a first glass of wine and a second glass of wine. And in the middle of that, in Mishnah Gimel, Hiviu Lefanav, like Sam said, it's again a past tense third person plural verb that has to do with presenting food. Mazgu, they poured. Hiviu, they brought. In both cases, food is being presented to the participants in the Seder. So Mishnayot Bet, Gimel, and Dalet all begin with someone presenting food to the participants, as opposed to Mishnah Aleph, which we said wasn't part of the Seder, it was the introduction to the Seder.
Do we think, have we said so far whether there's been benching after the meal? Is that clear to us from reading the Mishnah?
That's a good question. It's a wonderful question. It's such a good question that I'm not going to answer it.
Okay.
Because it will give too much away. actually, it almost leads us into the second question, which David figured out before we asked the question. The second question on my sheet is, in light of the content of the previous Mishnah, right, Mishnah Gimel, that we reviewed just 5 minutes ago, had you known nothing about the unique structure of the Seder, nothing, you didn't know anything, you've never been to a Seder before, but you're a regular Jew that's been to Shabbat meals and community meals and everything, what would you think is the ritual purpose of this second glass of wine? David?
Prevention.
Prevention. Right. Very good.
Sure.
Very good.
Assuming there are 10.
Assuming, you know, even less, you don't need 10 yeah. to bench. So, Mishnah Bet said Mazgulo Kos Rishon, that was Kiddush. And then Mishnah Gimel said they brought the meal. And then Mishnah Dalet says Mazgulo Kos Sheni, and our normal reaction should be, it's the Kos Shel Bracha, the Kos of Blessing for Birkat HaMazon. And by the way, not only is that our normal reaction, it's actually also the normal reaction of our kids. We're sitting on the table, they see us bringing a second glass of wine after the kiddush and after the meal is finished, they say, ah, we're about to say Birkat HaMazon.
My kids say Abdullah.
Although it's not explicit up until this point that we've had... Oh, yeah, it is. We've had matzah.
We've had matzah. Yeah, we've had maror.
Yeah,
we've had
so
pesach.
Plausible.
What else do you need?
We ate dinner.
And we think we ate dinner.
And we, the korban pesach. Yeah. That's the main course.
Mm-hmm. And the chagigah.
And the chagigah.
But it doesn't say they brought the chagigah.
Right.
But it does say they brought shnei tavshilin, and we know that one of the two is a replacement for the chagigah.
That's logical.
Okay. Let's go on to question three. In light... I gave it away, actually. Almost gave it away. In light of the answer to the previous question, why is this the most logical point for the child to ask the questions that the Mishnah lists?
Oh, because the meal's about to end? The
meal's about to end. Right.
And we already...
And we ate what we're going to eat.
And he's going to go to bed after we bench.
Yeah. It wouldn't make sense to ask why to tonight. It would not make sense to ask why tonight do we eat matzah and not bread if the meal hasn't completed itself, because always there's a chance of bringing bread. Same thing with the tzli. Why ask why do we eat tonight only roasted meat? If we haven't eaten meat yet, who knows what Ima's going to bring. But if she brought the food already and we're already finished and all it was matzah and this barbecued meat, well then you can ask, why tonight do we have only matzah and barbecued meat? That makes sense. So apparently, in a certain sense, the kos shel bracha, the koshini, is a signal to the kids, there's nothing else we're going to eat tonight. And then they start asking themselves, well, why is that all we ate?
I have a question regarding that. It seems from this that you can't infer whether or not it's the father who asks the questions or the child. It doesn't
matter what
you say.
Very good. We're going to get to that. That's a very good point. And I'm going to disagree with Brooks when we get to it. But that's the opening volley, salvo of an argument over how to understand their words we're about to come to. And that brings us to the next question. Question four. What type of dot is it exactly that the Mishnah is referring to? So that brings us to the next few words, which I'll read again. The end of the first line of Mishnah Dalet says, "Vim ein dat beben aviv milamdo." If there's no dat in the son, his father teaches him. So the question is, what does that mean? No dot in the ben.
The dot means he's dumb or something. He's not smart enough.
Not smart enough for what?
He's too young.
For anything.
But what specifically? No, in the context
of... realize that there's a difference.
Right.
Oh, for the Seder, for the night, yeah.
Yeah. He's not smart enough, or not old enough, or not aware enough to realize that something is going on tonight. So it's not intelligence in general, it's basically curiosity, or it's basically sensitivity to what's going on around him. And it could be a matter of age, could be a matter of personality.
Tired, how tired they are.
How tired, right.
He's interested in football.
Maybe since he drank the first course, he's a little trickier.
He's drunk, okay.
Yeah.
Right. So, vim ein dat beven aviv milamdo. And those words, aviv milamdo, his father teaches him, brings us to what Brooks began to bring up. Let's just read a few more words to make sure we see the flow of things. We said, the second glass of wine was poured, and here the ben asks. And then it says, if there's no curiosity in the son, his father teaches him. And then it says, manishtana, etc. So that brings us to my next question. What is it exactly that aviv milamdo? That's what Brooks was bringing up. What is it that his father teaches him? Let's ask Brooks. What does his father teach him?
It could be he teaches him to ask questions. It could be that he teaches him the questions to ask.
Okay. I think that's the pshat. No.
Yeah.
What is it, Aviv Milamdo? Aviv Milamdo, Manishtana. his father teaches him, call it to ask the questions, call it to notice what's going on, but we're not talking about teaching him anything about Yitziat Mitzrayim. That hasn't come yet. We're teaching him to be aware, either to ask or to notice, or just we point out to him what has been different tonight. That's what's going on here.
Can I ask, does the Hebrew grammar on its own without the question mark imply that that's a question? As opposed, in English you could just slightly change the order of the words and it wouldn't be a question. In other words, you could say, he's to tell him why this night is different. Just a slight change in the order of the words, as opposed to saying, why is this night different?
Can you say it in English?
Tell him why this night is different from other nights. Father, tell him why this night is different from other nights.
Right.
Whereas yeah. For a question, you'd say, why is this night
right,
different?
Right. And you're right. That is a machlok among the mefreshim, among the commentators. In the case in which the son doesn't ask, what does the father teach him? And it's a very slight difference. Do you teach him to ask and say, why is this night different, and put in his mouth the words? Or do you point out to him that this night is different because of X, Y, and Z? It's very subtle. I really don't see that it makes a big difference, but it is a machlok between Tosfot and I think Rashi. I'm not sure. Tosfot says that you teach him. I take it back. I don't remember who says what. Take it back. Yeah. Yeah.
How come he would be aware, for example, oh wow, we dipped two times instead of one time? You know, is the child really aware that the other nights we only dipped once? Okay. So, I probably wasn't aware of that. I wouldn't have been aware of something like that when I was 8 years old. You know, did we dip once tonight or twice?
If there are set customs for a banquet meal that are suddenly violated, the truth is I think that a kid of 8 notices more than I do.
I think a kid of 3 notices.
Yeah, I know. Everyone's different,
so
of course.
There was a set custom to dip once.
There's a set custom to dip once, right, as part of the appetizers. And I think we also talked about the stream of Masechet Brachot.
It's cultural also, right, we would say.
Right, it wasn't just a Jewish custom.
Yeah.
It wasn't just a Jewish custom. That the dipping of a certain of a vegetable in something was done before they actually got to the main meal.
Not to be silly about it, but also last year, when you're 8, last year you heard your older brother ask that question. Right? Mm-hmm. At the Seder.
Although once it becomes a part of the ritual, then it loses the,
right.
It loses the right. significance of
Right. And we'll get to that a little bit.
Okay.
We saw a Gemara last week that you might not remember. I won't remind you until we get to it. That deals with what we're discussing right here, and I won't say what I mean. Leave you in the dark. Leave you in the dark. Okay. Question 6. If the child does have dat, so that haben shuel aviv, I'm in question 6. How and what does he ask? Read that question again. If the child does have dat, so that a ben shoel aviv, how and what does he ask? Might be a hard question.
Are you asking in general? Is it giving examples of questions that he may ask? He may ask any of these 4 questions, or something related to them.
I'm not going to answer. I'm just going to...
Wait, so maybe the dot means that he's aware, but he doesn't know the answers. Like,
we haven't gotten to answers. We're talking about the act of questioning.
Yeah.
Look, here you have to kind of forget the Seder that we experience, and just look at the words of the Mishnah. Mazgu lo kosheni v'chan haben shoel lavi. V'im ein dat beven... Aviv milam do manishtana, etc. So, I'll ask the question again. If you have the case, which is clearly the optimum case, that there is dot in the ben, he does notice, then what he does is Shoel Aviv. It says Shoel Aviv. What does he Shoel Aviv?
So it's not really sure that he asks four questions.
Right.
Four questions from
Adam. Right. Right. The four questions here are only for the case of Ein Dat Beven. He doesn't know how to ask himself. And then you teach him to ask, or you teach him to notice.
Right.
But what happens if what's supposed to happen happens, which is you pour the second glass of wine, and then Haben Shoel, what does he ask? He doesn't ask the four questions. He says, Abba, why are we saying Birkat HaMazon? We didn't have any bread. He says in his own language. Or he says, why are we saying Birkat HaMazon? We didn't have any dessert. We only had this barbecue. It was delicious, but I want something sweet.
Right.
Why is this night different?
This is very interesting.
He might say, why is this night?
Or yeah. Nowadays, he would say, that's why are we getting the bench? We didn't eat dinner yet.
Exactly. Right. You hear what David said?
What?
What David said?
Why didn't we? Why are we benching? We didn't eat dinner yet.
Right. Yeah, because we're used to... Right.
You see how important questions were by children to force them
to engage them.
Questions.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I have a question. Has matzah been eaten?
Matzah has been eaten, right. Maror has been eaten, and the Korban Pesach has been eaten. According to the Mishnah.
But right. Something's missing still.
But they haven't had bread, they haven't had any vegetables but maror, they haven't had dessert. And then you start saying, you almost say Birkat HaMazon, you bring the kos. And the kids notice, wow, things are really different tonight. V'chana ben Shoel Aviv. And that brings us to the next question I asked. Question 7. Are the words V'chan HaBen, I have a misprint there, Shoel Aviv, are they prescriptive or descriptive? Are they prescriptive or descriptive? It's not an easy question, actually.
I would say descriptive. Descriptive, because it's what may happen.
We can take a vote.
But I don't see any command. I don't. Well, Mazgulo is a command.
Bechan means here, at this point.
Mazgulo is, prescriptive.
You said first prescriptive, but I would agree.
First I said, Mazgulo is prescriptive, because they're telling them that they should come and pour him the second glass. So if I read it, if I want to be consistent, then I would say it's prescriptive.
Yeah, I think it's prescriptive because I should have said here the Ben asks the father or the father asks.
It says here the Ben Shoel asks, right?
Yeah, it doesn't give another option.
Doesn't give another option.
But how could it be prescriptive? Because how could we command the? It's hard to understand how we could command the child to ask.
Right. For next year, because when if it was prescriptive, it'd be for next year because it's already isn't it already after they've eaten?
After they've eaten,
it's time for the Magid.
It's time for the Magid. Right.
You want questions now.
So it's really not clear if it's prescriptive or descriptive. I think everything that everyone said is true. You really can't command the kids to spontaneously ask questions at this point. That's a contradiction in terms. It is ideally descriptive. In other words, if you've organized the Seder correctly, and you've had the food on the table in the proper fashion, there really was no other vegetables, and no other meat, and no bread. And if, I guess, you do the proper hints, then, naturally speaking, descriptive, this is the point when the kids start breaking out with questions, simply because they see the meal is finished, and it's now or never. It's really descriptive. It, again, might be prescriptive in the sense that you could do certain things to encourage them to ask, but it's not a matter of handing them a Haggadah and saying, read.
Right.
That's certainly not what it's about. It's a description of what's supposed to happen in the correct case. I'll just tell you, this is a matter of ambiguity. Our Mishnah says V'chan. There are certain Rishonim that have a different girsa. The Rashbam has the girsa of Kain, not Kan but Cain. What does that mean? Cain haben shu'alavi.
Thus.
So Cain, some say it means thus. The Rashbam interprets it to mean language of Cain in the sense of honestly, for real. That's, and here, really the children ask. Probably something like, naturally the children ask. That's the way the Rashbam interprets it. Here, you pour the second glass, and the children naturally ask. They may not be then, but if the child doesn't naturally ask, then Aviv Milamdo Manishtana, his father teaches him Manishtana. That seems to be the pshat of the Mishnah. Okay. We're going to stop here for a second and look at the Mifrashim, look at the commentators. I brought commentators at the bottom of the page in E, but we're going to look at them right now in the flow of things. So we're going to see the Rashbam and the Maram Chalawa and the Mukhi Yosef and Rashi and the Chidushei Maharich. All those commentators we'll see right now. So first we look at the Rashbam, which I photostatted on this page. On Tractate Pesachim Perek Yud, the Perek we're learning, in the traditional Gemara, and also in Rav Steinsaltz's edition, not only is Rashi and Tosfot printed on the page, but also Rashbam. Mm-hmm. Also the Rashbam's commentary, the running commentary of the Rashbam on the Talmud is printed. And here the Rashbam says...
Can you point to where you're...
Yeah, the Rashbam is at the bottom.
Thank you. Okay. At your brackets at the very bottom.
In my bracket, right. And the Dibur Matril of the Rashbam is from a Gemara we learned last week, at least I think we learned it last week, and it is Patartan Milomar Manishtana. Yeah. You have exempted us from saying Manishtana. Okay? So if you remember last week, we have a story last week, yeah, of Abaye was a young orphan, and he was adopted by Rabba, who was a generation older than him, and at the Seder, we saw that Rabba took the table away. We said this last week, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Abai said, why are you taking the table away? We haven't eaten yet. And Rabba answered, Patartan Miloman Manishtana. You've exempted us from saying Manishtana. Right, so that was the stage in which they had removed the table, but they didn't have the food yet. Everyone with me?
And then you said you did that in your house.
Right, right. And so, what does it mean, Patartan Miloma Manishtana? You've exempted us from saying Manishtana. So we can read in the Rashbam, we can skip the first line of the Rashbam, and go on to the second line. Begin at the very beginning of the line. It's the last full line, beginning with the words, V'chevan Shisha'alu Lanu Manishtana. And since they have asked of us, quote, Manishtana, how is this night different? Ein anu tzrichim lomar Manishtana, we don't have to say Manishtana. Ela lashiv al dvarav, rather to answer his question. Lefish nishtabdu b'mitzrayim, because we were slaves in Egypt, anu usim kol advarim ele, we do all these things. So here we have in the Rashbam very clearly that you don't have to say the four questions. If a child said, why are you taking away the table? We didn't eat yet. Well, you don't have to have the four questions at all. You just go on to the Magid. And that is in our Mishnah what it means when it says, V'chan haben shu'el aviv. And if indeed haben shu'el aviv, then there's no need for the aviv lilamdo to teach him manishtana. He already did it himself.
That particular question or any question, because the Rashbam seems to indicate it's the Akirat HaShulchan that he's asking about, right? That the son is asking about.
We'll answer that right now.
Okay.
And according to the Rashbam, commenting on the Gemara, we might think that it's only the particular question of why is the table taken away that exempts from Manishtana. But in the Mishnah, you wouldn't think that. The Mishnah says, V'chana ben Shoel.
Right.
And only if he doesn't Shoel, Aviv Milamdo. So after the Rashbam, let's look at the Maram Chalawa, and you've probably never heard of the Maram Chalawa.
Sounds Arabic.
Sit in.
Sounds Arabic.
Sounds Arabic. Well, most of our Rishonim, except those in Ashkenaz, of course, were from Arab-speaking countries.
Right.
It's the Rambam and the Ramban. So, Maram Halawa was one of the Rishonim, and we only have his book on Masechet Pesachim. So unless you learn Masechet Pesachim in Yeshiva, you probably never heard of the Maram Halawa. So his commentary I brought at the bottom of the next page. And his Dibur Matkil is Mazgu lo kosheni v'chana ben Shoel. Right? That's our Mishnah. They poured for him the second glass. And here the son asks, says the Maram Halawa, Mishum de'akshav okrin et ha'shulchan. Because that now we've uprooted or removed the table. So here it's clear that he's, because they took away the table, that's why he's asking. He's not asking because the Haggadah says to ask four questions, and he's not asking four questions. He's saying, why are you moving the table? Just like the Gemara said concerning Abaye.
So it would have been assumed that they would have removed the table sometime a little bit before the time or around the time the second glass was poured.
Right.
That would have been assumed.
Right.
Which our
mission. That's the custom. Yeah. You clean off the table, then you bring the kos for Birkat HaMazon. I should be more careful. You bring the table back,
right,
and you put on it the kos for Birkat HaMazon. So after we saw the Maram Halawa, we'll see the Nemuke Yosef, which is he's a Rishon that has written, I think, in all the Hashas. But in most cases, his commentary, if I remember correctly, is on the Reef.
Uh-huh.
And not on the Gemara directly. So it says in the Muke Yosef.
What should you just tell?
I'm sorry.
About?
No problem.
Thank you.
Says in the Muke Yosef, the Chan haben Shoel. He says, Chan bimizigat kosheni nivarech alav v'halo lo achalnu adayin. Translation. The Dibur Matchil is, here the son asks, says the Muki Yosef, here. What does it mean, here? What's the specialist of here? Why does he ask here? So he says, here, with the filling of the second glass, he asks, we're going to bless now, Nivarech Alav, we're going to say Birkat HaMazon, and behold, we haven't eaten yet.
We have a question.
This assumes that the Seder, that the order of the Seder is as it is.
Right. That's very good. Thank you for pointing that out. Right. The Maram Halawa, who said the kids asked, why did you take the table away? Obviously, that's only a question if we haven't eaten yet.
Right.
And the same thing with the Muki Yosef. The son says, we're bringing this glass of wine, and behold, we haven't eaten yet. There, in the reality of the order of the Seder as we have it today, in which the eating has been taken away, but the Akirat HaShulchan and the kos have been left in place. Right. In the time of the Gemara, we can assume that the children didn't ask, why are we taking the table away? They understood. We take it away because the meal is finished. Rather, they asked, why did the meal include only the things it did? Why did the meal include only Pesach, Matzah, Maror, nothing else? But if you didn't have the meal yet, you can't ask that because it didn't happen. All you can ask is, why are you taking the table away? Why are you saying Birkat HaMazon? We didn't eat yet.
What about the case of Abaye?
Abaye.
Was he after?
He was after they made the switch, apparently. Abaye said, why are you taking the table? We didn't eat yet. In his time, which is four generations after the editing of the Mishnah in the year 200, and it was about the year 350 of the Common Era in Babylonia, it's quite a while after Chorban HaBayit in the year 70 of the Common Era, and they've already made the switch so that the meal, it takes place only later. Now let's look at the Rashi. We have to go back to the previous page. I put a set of Rashi on the Gemara.
What was Sam touching on?
Sam was just pointing out that all the Rishonim we saw, as well as the Gemara about Abaye, you're assuming that the meal doesn't take place where the Mishnah has it taking place. And that's true. That's true. So here, we're looking at Masechet Pesachim, and this is the page that has our Mishnah on it. Right? And in the upper right-hand corner is the commentary of Rashi on the Mishnah. The upper right-hand corner. I see that I don't have it in brackets.
Okay.
And it says Mishnah, V'chan haben shoel et aviv. And here, the son asks his father. Note, very interesting, that Rashi's Dibur Matril has a slightly different girsa than our Mishnah. It's meaningless.
Oh, et. The et. Et. Yeah.
Right, the word et is missing
that's
from
like
our...
modern Hebrew.
I'm not sure it's from like modern Hebrew.
Oh, that's I
don't know the Mishnaic rules of the use of the word of et. Right. The Chana ben Shuel et Aviv says Rashi, Chan b'mizigat kosheni haben Shuel et Aviv ma nishtana akshav shemozgin kosheni kodem achila.
The same thing as the Nimuk Yosef.
Right. Translation. And here, in the pouring of the second glass, the son asks his father, why is this night different? Now, let me be more exact in translation. Why differently now that you're pouring the kosheni before we eat? Now, why are we about to say Birkat Hamazon if we haven't eaten yet? We did that to Brooks a few minutes ago and he didn't ask. Right?
That's,
he said Birkat Hamazon.
Is there a certain, historical unawareness?
Yes, there probably is historical unawareness. In other words, it could be that the Rishonim weren't aware of the change in the order of things.
Mm-hmm. Or didn't think it was... Yeah, okay.
Yeah. I think that's amazing, though, that that's not one of the Manish Tanahs. If at this point, you know, this is happening, you know, such a strange, such a big change, that you think this is Birkas Hamazon, this point in the second cup, why wouldn't that be one of the questions for the child?
Let me think about that question a second.
Can I note that, I don't know about back then, but it's not our custom nowadays to normally have a glass of wine with benching. It's usually with some kind of communal occasion, etc.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so it could be that the glass of wine then, like now, wouldn't be a signal for benching. Not really.
But Reuven could still ask us, why isn't one of the four questions, why are we taking away the table?
I think
we didn't eat yet.
I think the reason is because the purpose of the Seder is to reenact and teach the story. And the four questions lead to teaching of the story. The point of this part of the Seder is just to elicit questions. And if a question comes about the table, if a question comes about the cup, then we've started the discussion. If no questions come, we start with the questions that are going to lead directly to the story.
I like that answer. Right, questions that are related to what's happening and lead to the story. That's good.
But they already did eat. In other words, this is early Tannaitic material. Can we say that it's...
We're assuming the Mishnah that is early material that was formulated basically before Churban HaBayit, right? And that they ate, and then Mezgulo Kosheni, and the kids ask...
So that's why that wouldn't be part of the Manishtana, because they already did eat.
No, but Reuven is correct that the Manishtana was changed after Churban HaBayit, as we're about to see.
Okay.
What we have in our Mishnah is not what we say today.
Right.
And Reuven is asking, when they changed it, why didn't they add Akirat HaShulchan? But I think that Brooks has a good answer to your question. They added things that are still relevant directly to Leila Seder, not just quirks.
Right, so connected to that, we could say, why are we having four cups of wine tonight and not just, you know, one, you know?
Right.
So why are we now touching on all these other points and not that? Because that's also connected directly.
Well, here you could say... Okay, I don't know. That's a good question. That's a good question about the question.
Yeah.
Okay, I want to see now, after we've seen all these Rishonim, I want to see an Acharon, the Chidushei Maharich, which is on the last page.
Did you translate this whole Rashi? I'm sorry.
I thought I did, but I can easily do it again, no problem. Translating the whole Rashi from beginning to end, Mishnah. And here the son asks his father, here, at the pouring of the second glass, the son asks his father, what's different now that we are pouring a second glass before eating?
It's kind of the same as the Nimuk Yosef, right?
Of course it is, yeah.
Exactly.
All of these Rishonim basically say the same thing.
Yeah.
So now we're going to look at the Chidushei Ma'arich. Now you've probably never heard of the Chidushei Ma'arich, and I also didn't hear of the Chidushei Ma'arich until I found this. Even though it's been probably 20 years since I found the Chidushei Ma'arich, I still remember my utter joy on finding this because I was a very young teacher. I must have been 32 or 33. I just began teaching, and I was teaching this chapter of Psachim, and I began to realize, I didn't know anything about the history changing the time of the meal. I just began to see in the Mishnah something's going on here. And I read through all the Rishonim that we just read, and I didn't understand anything because I didn't bring up in my mind the idea that things are once different to the order of the meal. And when I discovered this Ma'arich after looking through hundreds of books, literally, who finally explained everything clearly, I was overjoyed. So here we go in the Ma'arich. I never heard of him before, and I never heard of him after. It's a very obscure acharon that I found at the back of some book, I don't remember where. But he makes clear what is obvious in the end. Here we go, in my bracket, middle of the fourth line. He's explaining Rashi, the Rashi we just read. Remember the Rashi again? Let me just read it once again to remind you. The Rashi says, here the son asks his father, why are we filling a second glass of wine? We didn't eat yet. Right? That's what Rashi says. Says the Ma'arich, Dehaya kashel Rashi, that it was difficult for Rashi. Lama machnis bein hadvekim im ein dat beven aviv milamdo. Translation, it was difficult for Rashi. And he means Rashi in grappling with our Mishnah. Rashi had a difficulty understanding our Mishnah. Lama machnis bein advekim. Why? And he means, why does the editor of the Mishnah, machnis, stick in bein advekim, between two sticky things? By two sticky things, dvekim, glue. Two gluey things. He means
sticky subjects.
Two phrases that should be one right after the other. Mm-hmm. Why does the editor put something in the middle of them? And I was going to explain what he means. Quote, im ein dat beven, aviv milamdo. If there's no intelligence in the son, his father teaches him. That's a quote from the Mishnah. Then he has Hey Lamed Lamed, which is a acronym, or Rashi Tevot, thank you, for Hava Leila Meimar. It should have said, Hava Leila Meimar, it should have said, V'chan HaBen Shoel, Manishtana. And here the son asks, Manishtana, etc., etc. V'achar Siyum, and after the end of the four questions, Hava Leila Meimar, it should have said, Vim Ein Dat Beven, etc. Let's go back to the Mishnah now and understand what he's saying. We'll go back to the Mishnah. He reads the Mishnah, and he's trying to tell us what he thinks Rashi was thinking as Rashi was reading the Mishnah. So the Mishnah says, Mazgu lo chosheni, v'chan haben shoel aviv. And the next words should have been, ma nishtana. It should have been, they poured for him the second glass, and here the son asks his father, ma nishtana, etc. In other words, if we're going to read the Mishnah in light of our present custom, then the words that say, v'mein dat v'ven aviv milamdo, they're out of place.
Right.
It should have been, mazgulo koshini v'chana ben shol aviv, ma nishtana. And the words, v'mein dat v'ven aviv milamdo, assuming that they mean, if there's no... they should have come afterwards. Meaning that, well, I'm not sure what they would mean. Right? I guess it would mean if the son cannot descend of himself, why the son is different, then I have to explain to him. But that's not the way the Mishnah is organized. It's organized differently. And the different organization teaches us that the manishtana is not what the son asks. That's rather what the father teaches him. If the son wasn't able to ask, what was supposed to have happened is the son was supposed to ask, doesn't say what, because it's not supposed to say what, because it's a spontaneous thing. That is, he's trying to give us the thought process of the Rishonim that got them to say what they said. And it's really obvious. Let's go back to the Ma'arich. It's really clear. It's so simple. But it's so hard if you're stuck in the preconceptions of the way we do things today.
So he's commenting on Rashi.
He's explaining why Rashi said what he said.
Because Rashi said, why don't you...
Rashi said what the son asks is, why are we saying Birkat HaMazon? You haven't eaten. And Rashi didn't say what the son says is Manishtana Halayla Hazeh. Teaching us again that the questions are not the questions that the son is supposed to ask. The questions are something else. What the son is supposed to ask is, what's going on here tonight?
In his own words.
In his own words. Things right. Are so different. You take the table away, we didn't eat. You're saying Birkat HaMazon, we didn't eat.
Yeah. Is this night different?
This night is very different. So now we are in the third, fourth, fifth, sixth line of the Ma'arich. I'm counting from the top, not from my bracket. The sixth line. And the first word of the line is V'chule, Hafav. And we're now reading from the second word, V'od, furthermore. Now the Ma'arich is telling us something else that's difficult in what's going on here in the Mishnah that caused Rashi to say what he said. V'od, furthermore, Kol hashelot shehen shoel. It might be a misprint. It should be shaben shoel. And all of the questions that the ben shoel, minayin yodea haben zo hashela. How does the ben know this question? Zo hashela rishon. How does he know this first question? Shebechol alot and all nights. Anu ochlim chametz matzah. We eat chametz matzah. Perush, she'anu rotzim ochlim o chametzu matzah, which means that on all the nights, when we want, we eat chametz or matzah. Shema halayla zeh, aviv rotzeh b'matzah. Perhaps this night his father wants matzah. In other words, how could a kid ever spontaneously ask, why tonight are we having only matzah? It might simply be that his father only wants matzah. It's not a question that would that makes really sense to ask. So he claims. Okay. Another, it goes on, let me find my place, I lost it.
That makes sense, especially some people eat matzah throughout the year.
Yeah. V'chein b'chol ha'shelot. And so for all the shelot, duch ba'atzmecha, ask yourself, lechein peresh Rashi v'chana ben shuel, and that's why Rashi explained v'chana ben shuel, and here the son asks, perush, hashela shel haben hu rak mashru'eh, the question of the son is only what he sees, b'mazgo, kospet, in the pouring of the second cup. Kodem achila, before they ate. V'tulo, and furthermore, not. In other words, all the kids really ask is what they see. What do they see? Pouring the second glass without eating. And that's strange. But no kid would ever ask, he claims, why do we have tonight only matzah? Lots of nights we have only matzah. Or why tonight are we having only romaine lettuce? Lots of nights we have only romaine lettuce.
Isn't that in light of the Rosh Baum that has Cain? Naturally, the son asks his father.
Well, you're right that we're going on the assumption, it seems clear from the Mishnah, these are natural questions. The reading that Chan is Cain only strengthens that. But the Ma'arikh doesn't have that reading. He has v'chan. He has the word here. But it's all the same idea. U'mifaresh ha-mishnah. And he explains the Mishnah. In other words, Rashi explains the Mishnah. Im ein dat v'ven v'chule. If there's no dat in the ben, etc. Az aviv milamdo. Then his father teaches him, Vomelo Aviv, and his father tells him, Halo Yishkan Kamashinuim. Behold, notice there are tonight a number of changes. Shabakulavot for on all of the nights, etc. Umisayema Mishnah. And then the Mishnah ends, Ulafi Dato Shalaben, etc. That's it. It's simple. There's really no other way to read the Mishnah. But we need the Ma'arikh to point it out to us because we're stuck, or many of us are stuck. I was certainly stuck 20 years ago in my preconceived notion. But it's really pretty clear that the son asks spontaneously. If he doesn't do so, then the parents teach him to notice.
But he doesn't understand as we would claim the change of the order.
The change of the order doesn't talk about that. As far as he's concerned, it could be that the order always was
right,
that we take away the table and fill the second glass before eating.
Right.
That's a good point.
Oh.
So I'm explaining the Mishnah according to the same structure and flow as all these Rishonim, but I'm just adding into the fact that when it was written, they actually had eaten already.
Which takes the question away.
Which takes away the question of why we sing Birkat HaMazon without eating.
Right.
But it simply means the question is, why are we finishing the meal now when we haven't had bread and haven't had other vegetables? My claim is this is the time to ask the questions as they're written here. Because earlier we might have thought, we're going to bring other vegetables, we're going to bring other food, we're going to bring other meat, we're going to bring bread. Now we know we're not going to bring all these things, and therefore the kids could ask about Pesach Matzan Moror. So you're right, thanks for pointing that out. I'm using these Rishonim to say something slightly different, the same structure in the Mishnah, but slightly different.
Because the Rishonim...
Say it again?
The Rishonim did eat pork.
Because the Rishonim did things in the order that we do them.
Oh, we did. Okay.
Right.
Yeah, they hadn't eaten.
Right. They had not eaten.
Right. Bread. They had not eaten.
After the, because of their mouth.
Right. I think he's asking some of the questions I was asking before. Why you know, how is the son going to know, you know, what to ask?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know?
I think the Rishonim, is this right, Rabbi, are roughly from the year 500 of the Common Era until 1500?
From the year 1000.
1000.
And until about, until the Shulchan Aruch, right, 1564 or something. Or is it 54? I get that mixed up. Okay. Is this okay to go on?
Could I ask, I mean, it seems like a novel interpretation about the order being switched. How did you come to, when did you start out saying you got excited when you discovered this? When did you discover this?
I was extremely perturbed with this matter of bringing the food and not eating it. It just didn't make any sense.
Right.
And then I found some the first commentators that point out that the order of the meal was probably different are Rav David Zvi Hoffman and his contemporaries in the 1870s, 1880s.
In Germany.
And that's when you have the Wissenschaft of Judaism, the beginning of the scientific study of Judaism, historical study, and there's Rav Meir Ish Shalom wrote a commentary on the Haggadah at the end of the 19th century, and they started to point that out. And they bring some Rishonim that there seems to be a hint in them that they were aware of this. And actually, just looking at this on Shabbat, I was just reading a book on the development of the Seder, going a few pages that I'd read in the past, and the author there says that it's pretty much accepted in all the historical research that the order was once the opposite of what we do today.
Is that Noam Sion?
Who wrote the book? No, not Noam.
Okay.
No. Someone else. Yosef Tavori, who's the brother of Rav Binyamin Tavori, if you've ever heard of him. Okay, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. Okay, back to the questions. Back to the questions. Question 8. What is the relationship between the words Ma nishtana halayla hazeh mikol halaylot and the rest of the content of the questions? It's easy, I just mean structurally. Yes, no problem. No problem at all.
In the Mishnah, it says that so the son asks his father, and it's like, we don't know what that means. But the explanation is that he asked him, why are we benching if we have a need?
I would say like this. The son asks his father whatever he asks his father based on what he notices. And in the time of the Mishnah, it would have been, we now ate the meal, we're now benching, and there was nothing but barbecued meat, matzah, and maror. That would be the question. After the seder of the seder was changed, the order was changed, and they didn't eat, now what the son probably asks is, why are you taking the table away and benching when we haven't eaten yet?
Right.
But the content of the question is not as important as the fact that he questions, that he opens his eyes and sees something. And then we say to him, I'm happy you asked that. I want to tell you a story.
And that leads into Magid.
It leads right into Magid. Yeah. And then we skip the four questions, as we saw in the Gemara. This is no need for them. If the son asks anything spontaneously, he doesn't have to have four questions. He asks anything spontaneously. Like Abai said to Rabbah, why are you taking the table? We haven't eaten. And Rabbah said, you've exempted us from saying the four questions.
And then you get to eat quicker.
Then you get to eat quicker.
I like that.
I mean, we could say that this is one question and four statements.
It's one question and four
corollary.
Four examples. Right? Yeah. The question is, why is this night different? And then you say four reasons why it's different.
We say arba kushiyot in modern Hebrew, right? Instead of sheidlot.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. Right?
Yeah.
Kushiyot would...
Like difficulties.
Four difficulties. Yeah. So just to notice the structure. If you wanted four separate questions, each one would have to begin with manishtana. Manishtana halayla zeh shebikol leilot. She. What's the difference? That. And then you have to go on.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go on to the question 9. What would seem to be the meaning of the word kulo? The word kulo appears twice in the Mishnah. Simple question, one answer, one word answer can do it.
Rock.
Rock. In English?
Only.
Only. Exclusively.
Yeah.
Right? Why are we eating exclusively matzah, or why are we eating exclusively barbecued meat? Kulo means completely, it's only, exclusively. Question 10. What verse in the Torah is behind the observation that this night we eat kulot tzli? Now we have the Chumashim.
No.
Right. Just like the Torah says that we have to have matzah and not bread, right? So the Torah says we have to have tzli and not other types of meat. I'm just asking you where it says that. Okay. Anyone know where it says that?
In Shmot,
right? Chapter Bet. Sorry, chapter Yud Bet.
That's what we laid last week.
Right. It's pretty recent.
We're looking.
We don't know yet. Someplace in chapter Yud Bet, we want to find where it says
eat it roasted.
That you eat only roasted meat.
On 351.
On 351, verse 9, right?
351, verse 9.
And it says, "Al tochlu mimenu na umvushal mivushal b'mayim." Right? Don't eat of it partially cooked or cooked in water. Ki im tzliyesh. Rather only shli'esh, roasted in fire.
So it's not just that we're not supposed to have bread, but only matzah, but also we're not supposed to have anything but roasted meat.
And that would be noticeable because usually we don't eat meat roasted, right?
I don't know. Just going to ask that why is there something about the roasting that keeps the bones as intact as opposed to boiling, which breaks everything down? Is there something there?
So as far as the reason for the roasting, what I often say, I'm not sure 100%, is that the mitzvah is to roast it whole. So if we remember that the Korban Pesach is a matter of declaring to yourself and to the world your allegiance to God and your repudiation of Egyptian idolatry, that they worship the lamb. So if you roast a whole lamb, there's no way to hide that you're doing that. You can't do it in your kitchen. You can't do it in the oven. You have to make a campfire, a lot of smoke. So everyone notices and everyone sees that you are killing the God of the Egyptians.
To use the
metaphor that Menachem Liptag, my friend and teacher, always uses, it's like burning the American flag on your front door and smearing the ashes on the doorpost.
Right.
On your front lawn, I should say. Your front lawn.
Yeah.
Right. That might be the meaning of the Tzli'esh.
That's Tanakh.org or Tanakh.com.
Tanakh.org, I think.
Org, yeah.
Not to say that's not reasonable and makes sense, but also, if there were, as I understand it, you don't have to, if you're going to, that a way of koshering in the sense of getting the blood out of an animal is to roast. That is an acceptable halachic mechanism to get out the blood.
Oh, but not to roast it whole.
We require
it whole.
And you would take care of that beforehand, before the cooking.
Well, if you had that instruction and that commandment, that's what I was sort of wondering, you know, so if those procedures weren't existent at that time, it crosses my mind that, but I see it wouldn't work very well, really.
It wouldn't, not a whole animal. You'd have to cut the animal up in order to get the blood out.
So presumably that was, it was not, blood wasn't removed.
Presumably the blood wasn't removed.
You mean there's no malicha? And,
well, I mean some was, because you know, but not in the way we do it, of getting, of soaking or something. You
but
couldn't have done that.
It may not need, I thought that if it's roasted, because I'm learning from Hilchot Malicha that when you roast liver, that takes care of
the
blood.
Yeah, but that's what I'm
saying.
Yeah. But
not
the Torah says roasted
with,
whole.
If whole means with the skin still on, then...
Then
it's hard to picture how that would...
The liver is a small...
Liver is very... It's only one organ.
Piece of meat,
Right.
Blood saturated.
No, you skin it, They skin it, don't they skin it?
I'm looking historically what the Torah says.
Yeah.
It says roasted whole.
Of course, I'm sure a lot of commentary says that they... Probably, I would imagine, says that they skinned it because it has to fit in with the halakha today.
Right.
But...
Right,
whether that's
but historically speaking, whole means whole, which would mean it would be a lot of blood.
Well, this is before Matan Torah.
Okay. I just didn't think of it.
Well, it's it repeatedly says in the Chumash, don't eat the blood because that's where the life is.
Nefesh,
it's a deep...
taboo.
It's a deep taboo.
And when you really
and
get
so it's a little hard to. I mean, it's you wish it had that it was a little bit more explicitly consistent, don't you?
And then when it comes down to the halacha, the practical halacha, I think that we have to just stop the blood from flowing, but we do actually we don't remove it completely. There are a lot of examples.
Right, so a little redness, but you soak it, and you do a lot to...
We're also not... the Torah's not going in chronological order, so it could be that...
The commandment was given later.
Right.
I'm
just saying that we know that the Torah's not following a chronological order. We're thinking of it as if They didn't know about it.
They weren't keeping
it. That the commandment hadn't been given, but perhaps there was something there.
We said the first commandment.
I can't imagine. What could you do if you're roasting it whole, if it really means whole? How would you get the blood out?
Taking it from live and...
It's hard. We don't have a way of doing that.
How did they kill it?
You mean you shecked it?
You shecked it, and so obviously a lot of blood does drain out when you shecked an animal.
It could,
but we wouldn't accept that as being blood removal.
No, we would have to salt and wash it and then salt it again.
It could be kosher before you cook it in water. I mean, you could. I don't think it's saying you hear you can't soak it in water. It's saying you can't cook it in water. So you could split the animal
whole meat, but it says whole, roasted whole.
Right, it doesn't say it can't be split open.
It doesn't matter.
Okay, look, I don't know. What it says is that you roast it, its head, its legs, with its innards.
Everything, with its innards, everything, as though not cut up.
And let's just remember that the only explicit commandment of the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, going back to chapter 9 of Bereishit, is not to eat the blood. Right.
Yeah, actually, that's... That's a very basic taboo to
part
Jews.
Of a live animal.
Yeah.
You don't eat blood.
Yeah. But so I don't know the answer. I don't know.
But is that correct that there are places in Melicha where it comes up that we end up, it's midoraita, it's only the blood that's flowing and not the blood that's
okay,
frozen.
Okay, but again, just dealing with a simple pshat here, I'm a little bit confused. Yeah. Let's put it like that. Okay, thank you, Dirk, for confusing us a little bit. Okay, so now
I don't think so.
We're going to need it later, another 10 minutes or so. We are now on question 11 and then question 12. Question 11 says, which are the two dippings that are referred to in the third question? The third question says, every night we dip once, and this is written at a point in which they dip once before the meal for the appetizer. It says we dip twice. I'm just making sure that we know what is our double dipping. Mm-hmm. We dip once, the talk last week, the parsley or the celery in salt water or vinegar.
Yeah.
And what's the second dipping?
The matzah and the maror.
Right, we dip matzah. Actually, it's the... it's more the maror that's dipped in the...
the maror.
In the... Yeah. Harosin. Right, that's the second dipping. But then what we do... We actually have a third dipping, because we eat the maror a second time with matzah, and then we dip the whole thing in the haroset.
In order to cover all opinions.
This 12th question might be a bit difficult. It requires us to read the Mishnah again. The 12th question says, in what sense is the last question very different than the first three? Let's do it together. The first question is about what? Matzah. The second question is about what? That's the third one. The third one is about roasted meat. The second is about...
The vegetables.
Vegetables, about the maror. So the first three questions are matzah, maror, Pesach. Whereas the fourth question is... What's the fourth question? Right, matbilin. Dipping. So the question, the four questions are, at least according to our Mishnah as we have it here, they are matzah, maror, Pesach, and dipping. Tibul. So how is the fourth different than the first three? Very different.
Biblical.
Say it again?
Biblical.
Right, the first three are biblical. We're pointing out, we're noticing, we're asking about biblical mitzvot. Yeah. Matzah, maror, Pesach. Whereas the fourth is not a biblical matter at all.
It's not even, well, okay.
Whatever it is, it's not biblical, so it's certainly different. By the way, in the Yerushalmi, there's only three questions, which makes sense. The fourth question, what's it doing there?
And we don't ask the sleep part.
Right, we'll get to that in another few minutes. Today, we've changed them completely, or changed them further, I should say. So the fourth question is problematic. Let's go on now to the Pesach Haggadah. So what I have in mind now is looking at the Haggadah and seeing how the four questions of the Mishnah have changed by the time they reach our Haggadah. And we have another one I see hidden over there. And there's actually Eric. Oh, Eric has one also. So I can look on. If you want to look at the four questions.
Page 8.
In this one, it's page 8. And mine.
Well, in my cards, we need extra.
Mine's 26.
I think we're okay.
Yours is 26. In my Haggadah, I have the art scroll. I have page 24 and 25. We're looking to compare, page 8,
okay.
Compare the four questions as they've come down to us in our Masorah, compared to what we have in the Mishnah, and it's different. We said that in the Mishnah, the first question is what? Concerning what? In the Mishnah, it's Matzah. And in the Haggadah, it's the same thing. I'm reading from my Haggadah. Shebechol HaLeilot Anu Ochlin Hametzu Matzah HaLayla Zeh Kulo Matzah. That's just like we have in the Mishnah. The second one is also just like the Mishnah. The second one in Haggadah says Shebechol HaLeilot Anu Ochlin Shar Yirakot HaLayla Zeh Maror. Just like in the Mishnah. But we get to the third and the fourth, it's a bit different. The third in my Haggadah is Shebechol HaLeilot Ein Anu Matbilin Afilu Pamehat Halayla Zeh Shtei Pamim. Whereas in the Mishnah, the word Ein is missing, and also the word Afilu is missing. In other words, all our Masorah does is adds two words to the third question. In the Mishnah it says Shebechol HaLeilot Anu Matbilin Pamehat. We dip once, tonight we dip twice. Ours says, every night we don't dip even once, tonight we dip twice. And that, of course, is a change that was made to reflect developing custom, that in those times they dip once, today we don't dip at all, so that's what we say. It's simple, that's simple. So the third question is adapted to changing circumstances. The fourth question is completely changed. The fourth question in our Haggadah, right, is what? In our Haggadah?
Ben Yoshvin or Ben Misubin.
Right, Misubin, that's about reclining. All nights we eat whether sitting or reclining. It doesn't matter, sometimes this, sometimes that. This night we eat Misubin, reclining. Whereas in the Mishnah, that question doesn't appear at all. Rather, in our Mishnah, we have the question about roasted meat.
About basar tzli.
Basar tzli.
Yeah.
So the question about basar tzli is relevant bizman ha-mikdash, the time of the temple.
Right.
Temple is destroyed. There's no longer korban pesach. You can't ask it anymore. And for some reason, there was a feeling you needed four questions. Just like there are four sons, the four glasses of wine, you need four questions. Even like I said, the Yerushalmi is only three. But the Mishnah had our printed copies of the Mishnah 4. So the one about Batsar Tzli was taken out and something else had to be added. And they added the one about the Misubin. Although the one about the Misubin was probably added before the Middle Ages. Because it says, we eat sometimes reclining, sometimes not. But it doesn't apply to the Middle Ages. Middle Ages, they don't eat reclining at all. Just like we don't eat reclining. Who eats, you know, lying down? So it would seem that the fourth question really should be revised, just like the third one was revised. The third one from saying we dip once, tonight we dip twice, it was changed, we don't dip at all. So the fourth question really should be, all nights we eat sitting and not reclining, tonight we eat reclining. But
The Mistura froze at a certain point.
Right. Okay. That's that. Back to the question sheets. And now the question sheet tells us to go back to the remainder of the Mishnah. It's part C in the question sheet.
Can I ask a question, Rabbi?
Yes, sir.
At what point in history did people get rid of reclining?
You mean as far as normal custom or halakha? I don't know exactly. It has to do with the end of Roman influence, of Hellenistic living. I don't know if that's the 3rd century.
Rich, fourth rich century. Way. Eat like a rich man.
Yeah. Like when did people stop reclining? I don't know. Perhaps the answer is when they left Eretz Yisrael. 2nd century, 3rd century. No more than that.
But this, a lot of this is from... Oh, it's not from Babel. That's the point, right?
It's not from Babel.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I'm trying to think now. If you go at the largest excavated city in the Middle East, if I'm not mistaken, is Beit Shan.
Yeah.
And you go to excavations in Beit Shan. I can't remember if they have anything about reclining there, if they have reclining benches or not. And Beit Shan existed until the 6th century, I think. It was destroyed in the 6th century.
And we wouldn't have our initials anymore. That's the ironic part. Don't they have all kinds of icons in a lot of the synagogues they found?
You mean the mosaics?
The mosaics, yeah, in the synagogues.
I don't know. You mean Beit Alpha? Okay.
We didn't daven there.
I didn't daven. Okay, the remainder of the Mishnah after the four questions. After the four questions, it says, in the last 2.5 lines of the Mishnah, Ulefi dato shelaben aviv milamdo. And according to the understanding of the ben aviv milamdo, in other words, after one of two things happened, either the ben asked spontaneously, or he didn't ask spontaneously and his father taught him to ask, or his father pointed out to him the differences, then, according to the intelligence of the son, the father teaches him. And what does he teach him? So the Mishnah says, Matril bignutum sayem b'shevach. You teach him by beginning with disgrace and ending up with praise or glory or greatness. V'doresh mi'arami oved avi ad shigmor kol ha'parsha kulan. We didn't translate that yet. We'll get into that a little bit later. So the question sheet says, what does Aviv Milamdo? So obviously, Aviv Milamdo, the story of Pesach, right? But what is that story? What exactly do you say? So the Mishnah says, what you do is you begin the story with disgrace, and you end it with praise or glory, which is making an important point, which is you don't tell him that we're doing this because we are free men. Or you don't tell him that we're doing this because of the Exodus. But it's more than, you have to tell a story that goes from A to Z. You have to tell a progression. That's to emphasize the change in situation and status of the Jewish people from Ganut to Shevach.
And it's that concept which some of us, including myself, were referring to when we were trying to add a reason for why it said Ani Sheva Yisrael. That it was starting us off from that point so that we could progress.
Okay.
Yeah. If at all.
Well, this is forcing you to relive the experience, it seems like, in a sense, because you're going through the historical...
Mm-hmm. The Mishnah talks about that in the next Mishnah.
Okay.
So it's talking about a process in which we're not ashamed of mentioning and emphasizing the Jewish people began Bignut, began disgracefully. Now what does disgracefully mean? There's an argument in the Gemara, one opinion, it's Rav and Shmuel that are arguing. One says it's a matter of physical, the other a matter of spiritual. In other words, do we emphasize that we were slaves or that we were idolaters? And the Haggadah is both of them. Both we were slaves and idolaters.
Our forefathers were adulterers.
They
ever believed in the void of Zorah.
Right. Right.
That's the reason.
That's one aspect
that's
of the Gnut.
Yeah.
We tell them that, and also tell them that we were slaves.
They come from a nation that was serving the Avodah Zorah.
Right. And we went through a progression.
Right. Religion.
And
that's where we are coming from.
Now, let's make it clear that just like we talked about in Masechet Brachot many, many, many moons ago, that at the time that the Mishnah was edited, the Shmona Esrei was only partially formulated. The same thing goes with Mitzvat Magid here in the Mishnah. Let's go back to the Shemona Asrei in Brachot. We saw that it's called the Shemona Asrei, which means there are 18 themes. But we also saw that it says if a Shliach Tzibur gets up there and says things we don't like, we mishakim oto, we silence him. Which means that he was making up the content of the blessings as he went along. 18 themes. But he decided how to express those themes in his own language. And if he said, remember, modim, modim, or if he said, may God's mercy get to the bird's nest, for example, we silence him. Because he was in a basically a free mode of speaking. Guidelines, but not every word. The same thing here. If the Mishnah says, matchil bignut misayim b'shevach, begin with A and end with Z, then you can assume that just about everything else is fluid. If every single word was already codified, it would have said, say this. It doesn't say this. It gives you guidelines of how to begin and how to end. What do you do in the middle between A and Z, between the beginning and the end? Well, that's what the next few words say in the Mishnah. After it says, matril bignut misayem b'shevach, then it says, vidoresh. Me arami oved avi, ad shigmo kol parsha kula. The word doresh is the root that means to interrogate, to question, to be more specific. In this sense, it means to expound, right? To explicate, to explain. To make a midrash. Make up your own midrash. And on what paragraph or what chapter, what words do you make your midrash? You make it may from the words Arami Oved Avi, which is Varim 26. Ad shigmur kol parsha achula, until you finish the whole parsha. So the mitzvah of the night, the way you fulfill the mitzvah of Magid, is beginning with Gnut, ending with Shevach, and in the middle, expounding upon a certain chapter in the Torah, which is Varim 26, beginning with the words Arami Oved Avi. And we will talk about that right now. Let's just look at the questions on the sheet, the remainder of the Mishnah, question 2. We already answered question 2. We'll just say it to make sure we got it. Question 2 was, does Aviv Milamdo, in the case where Ein Dat Viven, in the other case, or in both cases? And the answer to the question is,
Ein Dat.
No.
Okay.
Right. If Ein Dat Viven, we said his father teaches him to ask. If Yesh Dat Biven, the kid asks of himself. But once he asks, whether spontaneously or prodded by us, then will the fi dat tosho ben aviv milamdo. According to the son's level, the father teaches. In other words, you teach him whether he asked of his own or on because of your prodding.
Whether he's smart or not smart, he's teaching him anyway.
Whether he's right. Smart or not smart enough to ask.
Yeah, you still have to teach him.
You still have to teach him the answers to the questions according to his level.
Which is even a stronger argument that there is no fixed text at the time because...
Right, it's according to his level.
Yeah.
It has to be changed and modulated.
It means that there's different kids, you know, different kids.
Right, different kids. Arvata Banim. Question 3, what's level, the meaning here of Datosho Ben? That's simple, it means his
level of understanding.
As opposed to what the word dat meant at the beginning. There it meant curiosity or sensitivity to what's going on around him.
Right. You teach them all. Every child has to.
Every child according to his level. Question 4. We did already. What do you think is the point of the dictum? Matril bignut misayim b'shevach is to tell a progression, not just a static status, but talk about a progression, a development. And question 5, the exact meaning of Doresh, we said to expound in your own words, to explain the deeper meaning of biblical verses. Question 6 we also did. What do we learn from this part of the Mishnah as far as the rigidity or fluidity of the Pesach Haggadah at the time of the Mishnah? We see that to a large degree, at least for Mitzvat Magid, it was fluid. There were guidelines of how to do it yourself, but it was a do-it-yourself kit.
There was no art scroll.
There was no art scroll. Right. And then we get to a comparison, this is D on my question sheet, between Sefer Dvarim, chapter 26, verses 1 to 11, and the Pesach Haggadah. So let's do the parsha of Arami Oved Avi as it appears in the Torah. And again, what we're supposed to be doing is we're supposed to be darshaning this for our children at the Seder.
This is a perfect pasuk to darshan, right? Because it has about five different...
It's not clear.
Right.
Is it going to be in Shemos also,
it's going to be in Dvarim.
Dvarim. Dvarim, yeah.
Kitavo.
1068.
The beginning of Parsha Kitavo.
1068. You got it.
1068. So it begins, it will be when you enter the land that Hashem your God gives you as an inheritance, and you possess it and dwell in it, that you shall take of the first of every fruit of the ground that you bring in from your land that Hashem your God gives you. That's the Bikurim. You shall put it in the basket, a teneh, and go to the place that Hashem your God will choose, which is Yerushalayim, to make his name rest there. You shall come to whoever will be the Kohen in those days, and you shall say to him, I declare today to Hashem your God that I have come to the land that Hashem swore to our forefathers to give us. The Kohen shall take the teneh from your hand and lay it before the altar of Hashem your God. Then you shall call out and say before Hashem your God, an Aramean tried to destroy my father. That's one translation of Arami Oved Avi. That's the verse.
That's what we're teaching them.
That the Haggadah is to begin with. He descended to Egypt and sojourned there few in number, and there he became a nation great, strong, and numerous. The Egyptians mistreated us and afflicted us, and placed hard work upon us. Then we cried out to Hashem, the God of our forefathers, and Hashem heard our voice and saw our affliction, our travail, and our oppression. Hashem took us out of Egypt with a strong hand and with an outstretched arm, with great awesomeness and with signs and with wonders. He brought us to this place and he gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. And now, behold, I have brought the first fruit of the ground that you have given me, Hashem. And you shall lay it before Hashem your God, and you shall prostrate yourself before Hashem your God. You shall rejoice with all the goodness that Hashem your God has given you and your household, you and the Levite and the proselyte who is in your midst. Now let's analyze, as far as literary structure, what we just read. If there's Moshe telling us when you enter the land, right, and you have fruit, that you should bring the first fruits to the temple, give it to the Kohen. And then in verse 5, Moshe is still speaking and telling us what we should do later on in Jewish history when we are farmers, when we're in the land, when we have first fruits. We should go and bring the first fruits. And then we should say to God, beginning in the middle of verse 5, an Aramean tried to destroy. That's a quote of what we're supposed to say. And let's find out where the quote ends. Right? Where does the quote end of what we're supposed to say? Well, art school makes it very easy for us because it puts in quotes. But where does the quote end? Art school is right in this case. It's hard to be wrong. Where does the quote end?
Middle
of verse 10. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And now behold, I brought the first fruit of the ground that you have given me, Hashem. End quote. That's what the last thing I say. And then, after that, Moshe goes back to narrating what we should do. And you should lay it before Hashem your God, and you shall prostrate yourself before Hashem, and you shall rejoice. Fine. Now, the Haggadah says that when you tell the story of the Exodus to your children in response to their question, you do it by darshaning these verses. Now, that brings up a very big question. Why these verses? Right, we all know that the full play-by-play, blow-by-blow account of the Exodus from the enslavement to the Makot to the last plague.
It's in Shemot.
Chapter beginning from 3 or 4 to chapter 12. Why do we choose these four verses as opposed to these 6 or 7 or 8 chapters that tell the whole story? You've heard this from me like 4 times, right? So you can continue. to make a long story short, It's a very important question. It's a major question. It's such an important question. The answer is very simple. Had we used the verses in Shemot, the chapters in Shemot, what we would be doing is reading to our children. Uh-huh. And the Mishnah does not want us to read. It wants us to Doresh. Wants us to Darshan. Tell us a story in our own words. That's probably the first and foremost reason why the Mishnah chose to do it this way. It's not about reading, it's about telling a story in your own words. And when you tell in your own words, you add of your own experience, you talk to the level of your children, you make it relevant, you add things that you remember from your grandparents, you show the albums of how you were slaves and when you went out, you do the whole thing.
And we were a small nation, became a big nation.
Right. Oh, and this is Moshe. The interesting thing is, Devarim is basically Moshe telling in his own words the history of the Jewish people.
That's a good point. And going on from what Eric said, this is in the first person. These verses in the first person. It says an Aramean tried to destroy my forefather.
Yeah.
And then it says in verse 6, the Egyptians mistreated us and afflicted us and placed hard work upon us. And verse 7 says, then we cried out to Hashem, the God of our forefathers, and Hashem heard our voice and saw our affliction, our, etc., etc., etc. The verses in Shemot are not in the first person, in the third person, because there, it's, as it were, God describing, the narrator telling what happened to the Jewish people. We don't want a third person story. We want a first person story, because you're telling a story of what happened to me, to us. And then I'll say what I always say, which is that the Haggadah, which we're going to open right now, has in it an example of a drasha. The Haggadah brings all the words of this parsha and gives you a drasha that was said by someone on these words. But the last thing in the world that the Mishnah wants is you to read that drasha. Because then go back to Shemot and read. Why to read a drasha when you can read the real thing? But the idea is not to read. The idea is to doresh. And in a certain basic sense, if all you do is read, you didn't fulfill the dictum of the Mishnah, which is doresh. So if we just open up the Haggadah to the beginning of the drasha, we have to find everyone has a different page slightly. My drasha begins on page 32. Let's see, where does yours begin?
Text are you looking for?
We're looking for, right, we're going to go a little bit further here. We're going to go here to, it's page 12 in the Haggadah that most everyone has. Say Ulmad is really the beginning of the drasha. Say Ulmad, go and learn what Lavan Aramean attempted to do to our father Jacob. That is an introduction to the drasha. It's a drasha on the first few words, Arami Oved Avi, before they are quoted. But then, after those three lines of drasha, I'll read it. Go and learn what Lavan Aramean attempted to do to our father Jacob. For Paro decreed only against the males, Lavan attempted to uproot everything as it said, and Aramean attempted to join my father, Arami Oved Avi. So, I don't know if yours is printed. It's not as good as mine. Here I have the art school, which printed it well. It brings the verses in bold-faced type. An Aramean attempted to destroy my father. Then he descended to Egypt and sojourned there with few people, and there became a nation great, mighty, and numerous. That's the first verse of the Parsha, the Arami Oved Avi. See what I'm doing? Mm-hmm. And then the drasha quotes from what we just read, quotes a phrase of it, another phrase, another phrase, another phrase, another phrase, and brings a drasha on it. What does it mean, descended to Egypt? It means compelled by the divine decree. What does it mean, sojourned there? What does it mean, with few people? And it's a drasha in the words of a first century darshan 2,000 years ago. And then we finish the drasha on the first verse. We bring the second verse. The Egyptians did evil to us and afflicted us and imposed hard labor on us, with Deuteronomy 26:6. Then a drasha on that, going through each word. And then the next verse, Dvarim 26:7, we cried out to Hashem, etc. And then a drasha on that. Then the next one, Hashem brought us out. That's verse 8. It's drasha on each verse And just to say it once again, you're not supposed to read it. Because if you're reading it, you're not doing what the Mishnah says, which is Doresh. And we explain why Doresh.
This is not an answer to the kids. This is just a...
No, this is an answer. Is an answer.
This is part of an answer
yeah.
for the kids, yeah.
Why are we doing the Seder, they ask? Why did you take away the table? Yeah. Why are you eating matzah, maror, and pesach? The answer is because we were slaves and
because
God made us free men.
It's still an answer to the kids. You know?
Yes, for certain.
And I'm sorry to say at this point, people are saying, read faster, read faster, read faster. That's reality.
So there should be effort on both sides. There's effort to struggle with questions coming from the kids, and there's effort to answer. I mean, it's not rote.
Right, not rote.
It's very weak, though.
Now, what's fascinating and important is, I'm looking now at the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, keep the Haggadah open, keep the Chumash open, and also go to the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, right, or we just read, the last 2.5 lines of the Mishnah. It says, Matchil Bignut, I want to make sure everyone sees those words. Matchil Bignut is the last word of one of the last lines of the Mishnah. Matchil Bignut. Bignut is the beginning of the next line. Mm-hmm. Begin with disgrace. Misayim b'shevach. And end with praise. V'doresh mi'arami ovedavi. And make a drasha from the words arami ovedavi. Right? Ad Shigmor, until he will finish Kol HaParsha Kula, until you finish the whole Parsha.
The whole Parsha.
Now, it says, until you finish the whole Parsha. It says, until you finish the whole Parsha. It emphasizes, finish the whole Parsha. Once again, until you finish the whole Parsha. So let's go back to the Torah and figure out where is the end of the Parsha. Okay, where's the end of the Parsha? We're back in Deuteronomy 26. We said we're supposed to begin the drasha with verse 5b. An Aramean tried to destroy my father, Arami Oved Avi. Where is the end of the parsha?
I'd say pasuk tes.
You would say pasuk tet.
That's the last pasuk of it. Okay. No, sorry, yud. No, tes.
Could be possible, like it all is the break.
Yeah, until they brought us into Israel.
Okay, so I heard three different opinions here.
Yeah.
Some of you said that verse 9 is the end of the parsha.
Yeah.
Verse 9, everyone see
that's
verse 9?
Yeah.
He led us to this place and he gave us this land, the land flowing with milk and honey. Some say that the parsha goes on to 10. And now behold, I brought the first fruit of the ground that you have given me. Some of you said that. Some of you said it goes to verse 11. You rejoice with all the goodness that Hashem your God has given you.
Yeah. Okay.
Three different opinions. Now I want to ask you, of those three different opinions, which do you think is most relevant to our Mishnah? In other words, if we're using the story that's given here of Jewish history for the purpose not of Bikurim, not of the first fruits, but for Pesach, of the three opinions, that it ends with 9, ends with 10, ends with 11, which of those three opinions really do you think is the most fitting?
And it also, another qualification is it has to fit its bishvah.
Right. It has to end with something good.
Yes.
Well, they all end with something good.
Well, yeah. I mean, I could say some are better than others.
Well, the shvach is, he took us out, b'yot chazuku, b'zoroy ha'netuyah.
Okay, but also they brought us to this place and he gave us land flowing with milk and honey. Now, we'll agree, I think, that verse 10 is irrelevant to the Seder. Verse 10 says, and now behold, I brought the first fruit of the ground. We're not going to make a drush on that. Right? Because that's...
Payback to God.
Yeah. But that's not relevant. We're not talking about first fruits here.
Right.
So I would say the Parsha ends with 9, right?
Yeah.
Ends with 9. He brought us to this land and gave us this... He brought us to this place and gave us land, the land flowing with milk and honey. So I'm claiming it ends with 9. But some of you claimed it ended with 10, some said 11.
Yeah.
But what we all agree is that at least it goes up to 9. Right? At least it goes up to 9?
Yeah.
Right? Now go to the Haggadah and see where the drasha ends.
Yeah.
What is the last verse of chapter 26 of Deuteronomy that is brought in the framework of this drasha?
Verav, I think.
Say it again?
Eight.
He's right. Sam's right. Verse 9 is missing. It ends with verse 8. If I can look on with you, I can just show everyone which page it's on. It signs ends with signs and wonders.
15 at the bottom.
15 at the bottom. Right. Which is the end of verse 8.
You mean that's where it stops giving the word by word or the phrase by phrase drash?
Right, and then it goes on to further explication of signs and wonders. But it never ever, the Haggadah never brings verse 9. That's the point. And that's a big question. Because the Mishnah emphasized Doresh until you finish the whole Parsha. It could have just said Doresh and left it open until when. But it said explicitly until you finish the whole Parsha. Now, so let's look now at this verse 9 that's missing from the Haggadah. It's missing. It should be there and it's missing. Verse 9, verse Tet says, I read it in Hebrew and in English, it says, Vivienu el makom hazeh, v'ten lanu et aretz hazot, eretz zavat chalav u'dvash. He brought us to this place and he gave us this land, the land flowing with milk and honey. Now you understand, right? In other words, this verse most probably was part of the drasha once upon a time, but it was taken out.
It became a problem.
Because it became a problem. It wasn't relevant. It was wrong. Right? No, that was wrong, excuse me. It wasn't relevant to the experience of Jews in the Gola, in the diaspora.
So in 1948, why don't we bring this back?
So actually, believe it or not, you can go to the internet and find Haggadot that have this verse at. I don't know if they published in a hard copy of Haggadah.
Right.
That people have feelings going against tradition too much, but you can find all different types of drashot on the internet on verse 9. With the recommendation that you staple them into your Haggadah.
Right. Right.
To put it in.
Dayenu goes as far as the temple.
Dayenu goes only as far as the temple. Yes. Well, it says you brought us to the land of Israel, and then you gave us the temple in Dayenu. So that we haven't taken out of the Haggadah. Okay, so let's complete our study. I think, let's see if we have anything left or we're completely finished. We're finished.
Okay. What can we say about... I put this in the form of a question purposely. Socrates learning from this method or us learning from Socrates?
Articles have been written upon it, about it.
Wait, expound on the question.
Well, the Socratic method.
Oh, right.
Teaching is by, you know, by starting with questions and eliciting discussion and answers. Yes.
Actually, there is a Socratic dialogue called the Symposium.
Yes.
Which describes apparently a custom that they had in the days of Socrates of having friendly debates of question and answer in the framework of a meal. Mm-hmm. And certain articles have been written showing the connection between the Seder and the Symposion. And even they had four cups of wine, I think, in certain frameworks of Symposion. So I don't remember all the historical details, and it's just a matter of conjecture, but there certainly does seem to be a certain connection to this.
Okay.
Sure. But also add, that the matter of asking questions for the celebration of this holiday goes back to the Torah. It doesn't begin with the rabbis. And that certainly predates Socrates.
The questions, where do we
when
see
that?
When
your son shall ask you, you shall tell him.
Yeah, that's in the Torah.
No.
Okay.